Colonel Hollist, Reel 2. Can you tell me, Colonel Hollist, what life was like for the troops under you in your battalion?
Well, the first thing was that the battalion was usually at full strength, which made for efficiency. The soldiers and the NCOs, many of them had spent a long time in that particular battalion, having extended their engagements from 10, 12, 21 years. And thus they became part of a sort of mobile club. They were generally totally reliable because, having lived in that club for some time, it wasn't so much offending against army discipline, but they would be offending against their own club members, which would not be appreciated by his friends. I remember, for example, once a soldier of my platoon was criticized for not being very smart on the commanding officer's parade. And after the parade, I said to my platoon sergeant, you better put that chap on a charge, because I want my platoon to be the best in the battalion and not criticized by the commanding officer for being scruffy. He said, oh, sir, there's no need to do that. The platoon have already dealt with him. I said, what do you mean? They said they had him in the bath and they scrubbed him. The soldiers knew exactly how they stood on discipline. If they wanted to go out and get drunk, they knew exactly what the punishment would be and decided beforehand whether it was worth risking a fine of 5 rupees and having a booze up or not. If you find them 10 rupees, they would make their ill feeling known. If you underfine them, they'd imply that you were lunatic and didn't know your stuff. There was tremendous intercompany rivalry which kept everyone on their toes. But they were always, the soldiers, reliable. Whatever they did, if there was a big show on, you could rely on them to put out 100% show, because they were proud of themselves. There was a very good feeling between officers, private soldiers, and the senior NCOs. The sergeant's mess was a strictly run affair, which no officer would dream of going into without first asking permission. And the soldiers had their own barrack room where they ran it as they thought fit.
But weren't there some special problems with, as far as man management was concerned in India? I'm thinking of things like boredom. Was that a special problem to contend with?
That is always a problem and was fully appreciated by the officers, and thus the men were seldom left to themselves except for the afternoon siesta and after sport in the evening, when they were liberty to go out in the town or go to the cinema or do what they liked. There was always something going on. Sport was highly organized every day on a company battalion basis, innumerable competitions. There was swimming at Menorah and at Clifton. The soldiers usually were very fit and were keen to participate and keep themselves fit. This constant rivalry, it never stopped. Into platoon competitions, into company competitions, there was always something going on.
So you didn't have any cases of people attempting to commit suicide through boredom or anything of that kind?
I've never heard of a case of attempted suicide in the 5 years I was in India with Royal Sussex Regiment.
Coming back to the training, did you have any joint training exercises with the RAF whilst you were there?
This is a particularly interesting question, because joint training between the army and the RAF was almost unheard of in those days. But just about that time, we were interchanging officers. Thus, we had an officer with the RAF up at Quetta, and they had one with us occasionally down at Karachi to see what each side got up to. Up in the Khyber Pass, before the battalion came to Karachi, there had been, and there always was, cooperation between the RAF doing reconnaissance sorties when there was tribal warfare going on, so that they could try and spot where tribesmen were gathering. And in one case, an RAF plane came down, and an officer of the regiment, Colonel Dashwood, as he was to become, went out and rescued the crew, who later presented him with the wooden blade of the aeroplane, which was Colonel Dashwood's most treasured possession the rest of his life, and always adorned the mantelpiece in the officer's mess wherever the battalion went.
And you've already described the amount of cooperation there was with the Indian Army. Did the British soldiers and the Indian soldiers always get on well together, or did there ever occur any instances of conflict or rivalry?
No, both sides kept very much to themselves, but and met in the main on the sports ground, where there was a clear feeling of goodwill and mutual admiration.
Were you engaged in any operations in India of any kind?
I was involved in only one so-called operation, and that was the Karachi riots of, I think, 1934. This was the only time that the battalion was called on by the civil authorities to try and regain law and order out of a situation which had become very dangerous. These riots in Karachi were caused by Mohammedan murdering a Hindu, and he was duly incarcerated in the prison out near Drigue Road. And there was a request from the parents that the body should be returned to them so it could be taken home and buried. And there was a considerable delay in granting this request. And large crowds came in from the country and surrounded the prison. And eventually, after much dilly-dallying, the body was given to the so-called parents, who, instead of taking it home, decided to march it through the city of Karachi. As there was an interracial connection to this affair, it immediately meant a flare-up between Hindus and Mohammedans in the city. And this is probably some of the worst rioting that's ever been known in that area. The battalion was called out. It was then under command of Colonel Dashwood, who did his level best to try and stop the rioters coming into the city. But without a firm request from the civil authorities, nothing could be done other than shaking one's fist at them. Eventually, the local magistrates saw that the situation had got out of control and requested the battalion to fire. And this had to be done down a narrow street, some 36 Indians being killed. And this stopped it temporarily. The police had already left their barracks and disappeared. So come nightfall, I, as temporary commanding machine gun company of the battalion was told to take up a position in the police barracks and stop any move by the rioters through into the city past the police barracks. A very difficult position to undertake because a Vickers machine gun is an extremely dangerous weapon, because once you pull the trigger, a large number of people are going to get killed. Anyway, it should be sighted on the ground and not high up in barracks, because it's more effective on a flat trajectory. However, myself and another officer called Hugh Taylor sat down in the police barracks at about 5 o'clock, not looking forward to the night at all. And the only way we managed to amuse ourselves was by fashioning some darts out of the police pens and playing numerous games of darts. Nothing happened in the night and we were called in the morning.
You were called back to the barracks in the morning. And did you actually witness any of the rioting at any time?
Oh, yes. The vast crowds, and they came in, as were always in this case, a lot of innocent people in the front. Countrymen had come in from Les Bila and surrounding districts, usually to see the fun. Egged on by the malcontents who conducted their operations from behind. Thus, as is always the case, the innocent were killed and the real cause of trouble got away with it. Eventually, in this case, they decided to take the body out of the city, and the thing died down, but vast damage had been done to stores and shops and so on.
How many days did the rioting last?
Well, it started out at the prison. Although I don't know a great deal about it, I think it was the prison authorities, their inability to decide whether to hang the man or not, which gave time for the thing to build up. And I suppose you could say that from the time the crowd started building up at the prison, it went on for 3 days.
Can we go on to discuss mess life a little bit more, mess life in India? What type of food did you have in the mess? Was it English style or Indian style?
The food generally was very good, with the exception of meat. Meat is always a difficulty in a tropical country. Guest nights were miniature banquets. There was unlimited good fresh fish from the market. The ubiquitous chicken was always put in appearance in some form or other. Eggs, unlimited vegetables, some Indian dishes. The curries were excellent because there's no one can make a curry like the Indian himself. A great variety of these dishes, which are very appetizing. With the exception of the difficulty of meat, food was really very similar to what you would have at home.
And what type of dress did you have for dinner?
Usually, mess kit was worn, a tropical-style mess kit, and I think officers were quite prepared to put this on for the evening meal because it was a very cool form of dress. If one didn't wear mess kit, the standard dress was a dinner jacket, but this consisted of white cotton flannels and a black alpaca coat. Lightweight, in other words. Life in the mess was usually active. There was always bridge. By virtue of a battalion being at full strength, there were always enough officers, which is a great asset, unmarried officers living in the mess, so that fours of bridge could be played most evenings. Billiards, or popular thing was to take a party after dinner at the cinemas, which seldom started before 9:30 and went on till midnight. They were good air-conditioned cinemas with quite good films. There were the invariable dances at the clubs, or people would go down to the club to have dinner. There were two good clubs in Karachi, one the Sin Club and the other the Gymkhana Club. A day for an officer after work might be that he probably played cricket or some form of sport. He would then come home, come back to the officer's mess, and either dine in or decide to go out and have dinner at one of the clubs. There was a lot of entertaining went on, and particularly the civilians would ask officers out to dinner and so on. The whole society in Karachi was very integrated. Everyone knew everybody, although it was a very big station.
Do you mean integrated between the military and the civilians, or between the Europeans and the Indians, or both?
Well, this is a rather difficult question, because in the 30s, the British people generally kept apart from the Indian people. There was no ill feeling or anything. It was a sensible setup. In Karachi, there were the white clubs, the Sindh and Gymkhana clubs, and the Indians had their own clubs. But Indians would come and play tennis at those clubs, and if one got to know the higher class Indians, they would undoubtedly ask you to go and play tennis at their club. There was no integration of the two, but a clearly respectful understanding. Towards the end of my time in India, a plan was afoot for the white clubs to be thrown open to Indians. I don't know what happened, because the Royal Society left Karachi in 1935, and that hadn't come to pass at the time. It's a funny setup, because the Indian Army, which is such a fine service, particularly the Indian cavalry regiments, there was a close integration between them and their British counterparts. Both admired the other intensely, and both tried to set a higher standard than the other. But of course, this was made easier by the fact that the majority of the officers in the Indian regiments were white, British officers serving in the Indian Army. So the integration was much easier than it was on a civilian basis, where they may have worked together, but there was no common denominator which drew them together.
What do you think were the factors which made the two sides, Indian and European, not so keen to mix? Socially, I mean.
I think it can only be a matter of colour, custom, and desire. The ways of living were totally different at that time, although beginning to come together. And then, of course, there was the Anglo-Indian setup, which ran between the two. And I think the Anglo-Indian setup may have been the ham in the sandwich. It's rather a bad illustration, but it kept the two sides apart, I think.
In what way do you mean?
Because it represented the worst of the two.
So the Europeans didn't really have a very high opinion, you mean, of the Anglo-Indians?
Yeah, and vice versa. The great thing that the Anglo-Indians did, and will always be remembered, and that was the running of the railways. This seemed to be a job which could only be done by Anglo-Indians, and they lived there, and they lived on the railways. And you've only got to read some of John Masters' books, Bhowani Junction and so on, and there you are. If an engine was in difficulties on the line, there's only one of the people who could get that engine to go and get it at the end of its journey, that was the Anglo-Indian railway staff. And they considered this entirely their perks, and no one would have dreamed of trying to have intervened.
And what about mixing between Europeans and Anglo-Indians? Did that take place?
No, not a great deal, because, as I said just now, this, in my opinion, was really the nigger in the woodpile, because they were not really acceptable to either side.
Wasn't there even mixing between the other rank soldiers and Anglo-Indians?
Oh, yes. And many Anglo-Indian girls are very pretty, and thus the soldiers would be attracted.
What was the army's policy towards these liaisons and marriages?
Well, generally, the private soldier did not marry. He came out young and had no intention of getting married. The NCOs had wives, and if an NCO married an Anglo-Indian girl, well, no one would say anything. But you've always got to remember in these marriages that the child, first child may be white, the second one may be black. And although in this day and age that is not frowned upon but may be encouraged, in those days it would have been frowned upon, and therefore the soldier stepped carefully in that direction.
Coming back to the mess life, did you have many formalities in your particular mess in the Sussex?
Formalities, I don't think so. Life went on generally. There was always a guest night once a month when high-ranking officers, civilian or military, would be invited. Officers from local Indian regiments, white officers, that is, possibly from the Indian Navy if they were in port. These guest nights were a big do. These civilians liked being asked to them. It was always what you might call a riotous night, with a band playing and fierce games afterwards, which everyone seemed to enjoy. And they took place once a month. The degree of hilarity which took place depended entirely on the guests. If there were no one very senior, then all kinds of things might happen. But if the commissioner was there, or the governor, then it behoved one to act with decorum.
And how much attention was paid to health and sanitation whilst you were in India?
Well, the health and sanitation in any tropical climate, as you well know, always raises a problem. But on an archaic system, it was highly organized. The battalion had a vast number of sweepers who were responsible for keeping the place clean and getting rid of excreta and so on, which was deposited in the urinals and lavatories. The water was carefully watched by the doctors. Illness did break out, mild dysentery, but generally the fitness of the soldiers kept them away from ill health pretty well.
What about you yourself? Did you fall ill in India?
In 5 years in India, I was never ill at any time except when I put my hand in the safe in Hyderabad, Sindh, to get the payout, and found there was a large black scorpion in it, who fixed himself to my finger and made me feel very bad. I got on my bicycle and went up to the hospital as quickly as I could, and the Indian doctor looked at me and said, "There is nothing I can do. You should have come sooner." That is the only illness I had, and I cannot remember other officers being laid up for anything serious.
So you got no treatment for your scorpion bite?
No. It didn't half hurt there. It swelled up all the time.
You had swellings in the armpits, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, and the groin, and that kind of thing. The big black scorpion can be lethal to people of ill health. The native children die occasionally from a bite. But for a fit person, and as I said earlier, we were always very fit, the chances were negligible.